From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, Vandana Shiva, anti-globalization activist and editor of Biopolitics, a feminist and ecological reader on biotechnology.
In India, we have so far, both with a combination of grassroots movements, advocacy and lobbying in parliament, and a lot of very hard work, managed to block the implementation of that part of GATT that would turn life forms into private property of corporations and would give exclusive marketing rights to pharmaceutical and agrochemical companies to carve out larger shares of monopolies.
Then in South Africa, the official revelation of who killed Steve Biko, father of the Black Consciousness Movement. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission will probably grant them amnesty. We get reaction.
We believe in the Azanian People's Organization that these five security policemen have committed crime against humanity, and therefore they do not deserve any amnesty. They need to be taken to the court of law, where they will be punished severely.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Five former policemen in South Africa have confessed to beating anti-apartheid icon Steve Biko to death in 1977. But it could be months before they're called on to tell the nation why they did it and on whose orders. The five announced through their lawyer that they would seek amnesty from Archbishop Desmond Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation Commission for killing Biko while he was detained in an apartheid prison. Biko's family is against them being granted amnesty, which is precisely what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission will probably do. We'll have more on that story later in the show. Rwanda has reopened the trial of a prominent politician accused of being a ringleader in the 1994 genocide of minority Tutsis, despite being born a Tutsi. Françoise Karamira, former vice president of the Hutu MDR Power Party under the ousted Hutu government, is charged with genocide and crimes against humanity and is the most senior genocide suspect to come to trial in Rwanda. This news from Lima, Peru, members of a peace commission appointed to resolve the six-week-old hostage crisis at the Japanese ambassador's residence met formally for the first time in a step toward talks with rebel gunmen. The three-member commission briefed Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori and Japan's point man on the crisis on the existing conditions for the eventual development of talks. The composition of the panel, Red Cross mediator Michelle Minig, Canadian Ambassador Anthony Vincent, and Roman Catholic Bishop Juan Luis Cipriani, was accepted earlier this month by the government and the rebels, still holding 72 hostages. Saying that mistakes were made in the pursuit of campaign contributions, President Clinton told reporters yesterday that a top financial regulator should not have been invited to a coffee arranged by the Democratic National Committee for bankers who contributed to the party. At the same time, Clinton defended his role in helping his party raise record sums by granting donors access to him, saying these people got nothing for their money other than a respectful hearing if they have some concern about the issues. The question is, if you didn't have money, would you be granted such a respectful hearing in the White House? Senate Democrats yesterday put Republicans on notice to expect trouble in winning approval for financing their investigation of campaign financing abuses unless they clearly specify its scope and duration and ground rules for Democratic participation. In his address to the Senate, Senator Fred Thompson, who will lead the investigation into President Clinton's campaign finances, listed several broad areas of focus, such as whether administration officials observed legal barriers between fundraising and official business that appeared targeted mostly but not exclusively at allegations of Democratic fundraising excesses. He said that the investigation will be pursued without regard to party and that Republicans will in no way limit Democrats' rights to investigate what they deem important. He did not say how long the inquiry might last and caution that its duration depends in part on White House cooperation. The former commander of U.S. troops in the Persian Gulf War is to testify on Capitol Hill today. The Senate Veterans Affairs Committee wants to ask retired General Norman Schwarzkopf about unexplained illnesses of Gulf War veterans. and an army base where a dozen female recruits claim they were raped or harassed has accused a fifth soldier of a sex crime, and the number of those charged may grow. Sergeant First Class William Jones is the latest soldier to be charged in the sex scandal at Aberdeen Proving Ground, a base north of Baltimore. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Biotechnology is one of the most powerful new technologies currently under development, one that is threatening to radically alter life itself. Putting fish genes into tomatoes or injecting bovine growth hormone into cows to make more milk, biotechnology is only beginning to change what we eat and how we live. Vandana Shiva, the director of the Research Foundation on Science and Technology in India, is one of the leading critics of how biotechnology is being used. Her latest work is Biopolitics, a feminist and ecological reader on biotechnology. It has just been released. She gave a speech, and this is an excerpt of that speech on biotechnology.
I'd like to share here with you a brilliant statement by the Monsanto person who was helping, you know. There was a group of multinationals who had organized themselves in an intellectual property committee, who drafted the chapter in GATT on trade-related intellectual property rights. I used to say they've drafted it for their self-interest. It turns out they're telling the world we've done it. They're very proud about it. And this is what the Monsanto person says. What I have described to you about this whole lobbying and writing and drafting and pushing through these clauses, what I have described to you is absolutely unprecedented in GATT. Industry has identified a major problem in international trade. It crafted a solution, reduced it to a concrete proposal, sold it to our own and other governments. The industries and traders of world commerce have played simultaneously the role of patients, the diagnosticians, and the prescribing physicians. Now, if we are talking about the highest level of concentration of power, can you imagine anything beyond this? That you construct an idea, you impose it on the world, and then you create all kinds of literally criminal instruments to say if someone violates intellectual property right, they're not engaging in civil crime. It's not like theft anymore. It's the piracy in intellectual property is tried in criminal courts. And the powers available to the corporations include dismantling production systems even before the proof is there of piracy. And in terms of proof of piracy, the issues are becoming so complex and convoluted for the simple reason it has become possible for the corporations to announce that if a plant has a gene for high protein content, and if a corporation has a patent on that protein content, then any plant anywhere in the world, its very existence in the hands of a farmer is a violation of the intellectual property of that corporation. And some of these judgments have been given in the favor of corporations. I couldn't believe it earlier this year. I was in the UK. The UK groups didn't realize that the farmers this year were already being forced to pay 80% royalty for saved seed, for seed that was had grown on the farmer's land and was being put aside by the farmer for his or her own cultivation. The farmer's seed is treated as the intellectual property of the corporation that might have sold the seed 2 years back. So every year you're forced to buy anew. The very sources of rejuvenating, replenishing life in multiplicity, you know, the fact that a seed gives right to thousands, millions of seed, that whole evolutionary potential is cut short so that a seed can't give rise to another seed without a royalty payment to the corporation who has announced that every calf born to a cow belongs to them, every seed born of a seed belongs to them. They would have done this with women too, because you know we were constantly neutralized, like I said, as mammalian bioreactors. Luckily there have been, and when I count on my fingers who are the activists around the obscenity of patenting life and claiming life to be made and owned, they are a handful of women activists around the world. And I would like to today recognize them, even though they are not with us. And we've put out the primers. You'll get addresses there to contact them in all kinds of places. Some of the work they've done is just tremendous. The work they've done on the impact of genetic engineering, for example, which the corporations have insisted on saying there's no issue of safety. There's no issue of environmental safety in genetic engineering. We've come up with the ultimately safe technology, the ultimate green technology. And the same corporations that would go to GATT and argue, we have made something new, therefore we need property rights. We'll go to the Biodiversity Convention and argue in the biosafety discussion, no, this is exactly as nature made it. There's nothing new about it. Don't look for new issues. So it's natural in biosafety where you get running away from responsibility, and it's totally novel and a new creation out of the blue when it comes to claiming absolute rights. That separation between rights and responsibility, to me, is the highest symbol of patriarchal power. If there's one thing that characterizes irresponsible power, it is when rights and responsibility don't hang together. Well, some women scientists decided to do a lot of work on, for instance, the release of a genetically engineered organism that was supposed to be an environmental technology to eat up the waste, agricultural waste and straw left after harvesting. It turns out that this microorganism, if it had been allowed to be used commercially and the commercial clearances had been given by the United States Department of Agriculture and the EPA, the microorganism that was genetically engineered, it's called Klebsiella planticola, it did not allow any plants to grow. And it killed all the nitrogen-fixing bacteria in the soil by about 80%. Just competed it out. Competed out all life from the soil. The evaluation was done by a young woman scientist who had the courage to realize that it doesn't matter, I probably won't get my tenure. I probably won't get this paper published in any journal where the arms of the journal's editors can be twisted. But she's been there, out there, fighting with us on the biosafety issue in the Biodiversity Convention, where basically it's people asserting their right to respect nature, respect diversity, protect it, and not allow it to be privatized as the property of a handful of corporations. There are other areas in which actions have been growing. Those of you who are from the UK know, of course, about the very courageous direct actions against the live export of veal calves, of the shipping out of living calves to Europe for being slaughtered as veal. But free trade has not just converted countries where meat has been a major trade anyway. I was reading some statistics, and the FAO and the GATT predict that 300% in international meat trade will take place as a result of trade liberalization. In India, it has meant that the cow, which has been sacred in our culture, is today, by all kinds of means, including buying up the cows for slaughter at 4 to 5 times the normal price in the economy, being sent off for slaughter and then for export. I've seen this in many countries where the corporations step in to take over free economies where seed or animals reproduce freely and support our needs in food freely. The one thing they do is first buy up all of the animal genetic resources, the seed genetic resources, at way beyond the price. And since people are not used to thinking of life without cows or life without seed, they assume that, oh, I'm just getting a good deal, and tomorrow I'll go to my neighboring village and get my little chicken, or get a calf, or get my seed, because they're used to constantly replenishing their economic base in biodiversity through that kind of free exchange. And they don't realize that the process that has bought up there chicken and their cow has bought up everyone else's. And eventually the companies are there to just step monopoly. And there, of course, are the kinds of cross connections where the feed is linked to the to the same corporation that controls the chicken sector or the meat sector. And basically, farmers, instead of being autonomous producers, just become borrowers of credit to be then moved off the land when the economy squeezes them out. And that is the biggest issue in the free trade around food, because the propaganda around GATT, around why it was necessary to have GATT ratified, was that this was the only way we would remove subsidies in the food system. In fact, GATT has done just the opposite. It has institutionalized subsidies on a very huge scale for the corporate sector. And even in the final round of negotiations in GATT, you might remember there was this thing called the Blair House Agreement, and after that a peace clause between the US and the European Union, during which time Mickey Cantor and Leon Brittany went off for 2 weeks into a locked room and agreed to not touch their subsidies. And then came out and announced to the world, here's a multilateral treaty that 100 countries and more have agreed to by consensus. All the subsidies that the corporations get at every level, starting from transport, research, intellectual property rights itself is a huge subsidy, because the subsidy society is giving by handing over what is a common resource into the hands of corporations, a subsidy that allows them to basically collect rents from life forever. We are having a new burst of movements in India, as in the UK, around the rejuvenation of the culture of reverence and respect for animals, recognizing that we humans are just one among the species that inhabits this earth. And personally, I really feel that the whole issue of women's empowerment needs slow ride. We can't get out of some of the deadlock in the women's movement unless we widen the way we articulate our own concerns as humans and democracy among humans into a democracy of species. That step is absolutely crucial for us to have more respect and dignity for ourselves. We have to give it to others who have been excluded, including other species. We've also in India recently, partly to not allow the concentration camps for animals to be exported out to us, where thousands of chicken, calves, and I don't think they'll ever have pigs in India, because neither the Hindus nor the Muslims eat them. But maybe they could convert even India into a pork eating culture. Well, the Kentucky Fried Chicken tried to open its first outlet about a month ago in the city of Bangalore. It hasn't yet started to fully function, because we've had a protest going against it, not just for one reason. We definitely are protesting Kentucky Fried Chicken for its cultural imperialism of expanding junk food into the rest of the world. We believe that at a time when even in Western countries people are starting to get very worried about how animals are treated, a country like India doesn't have to give up its culture of respect to imprison our livestock. We need free chicken, we need free animals, and our farmers know how to feed people even while keeping space for animals. We have pluralistic agricultural systems. We have agricultural systems that are not just for soybean, not just for chicken, not just for cows as meat or cows for dairy. We have systems that are so multifunctional. And they're very productive. It's just that concentrated power, the corporations never worked out the productivity of these systems because it doesn't suit them. We're working out this productivity. And We are saying no to the concentration camps for farm animals. And this year, 2nd of October, which is Gandhi's birthday, we are celebrating particularly as Ahimsa Day, as the day of non-violence, in terms of our relationship with other species, in terms of how we think about them, how we deal with them, how we use them in production, and how we consume. So that it runs all the way through the food chain. And we need to bring ahimsa right into the food chain, because that's where ultimately the test of non-violence is. Consumers around the world have been organizing around issues in which lend themselves to consumers. And I think one of the most exciting movements is around the issue of labeling. Either the labeling of genetically engineered foods, which are interestingly called novel foods. And again, while they're called novel foods when it comes to selling them and putting them on the market, when it came to the hazards, to the health hazards about whether these novel foods, you know, potato with chicken in it, would cause allergy for a person who had chicken allergies or was a vegetarian, you know, what class does a potato with chicken genes belong to? In the discussions or in the part of GATT that relates to food safety, which is the Codex Alimentarius, this big body which looks at food safety, the argument was given that since the gene is such a tiny amount by weight, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. And that same contradiction of its novel, you know, give it a special status, new subsidies, new clearances, but it's so insignificant, the novelty, you know, when measured by weight. The problem is the function of anything in our health or in the ecosystem has never had to do with weight. I mean, on that ground, the Ebola virus and the AIDS virus should not worry us at all.
And that was Vandana Shiva. Vandana Shiva, who was speaking at the Beijing Women's Conference last year. She is editor of the book Biopolitics, a feminist and ecological reader on biotechnology. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission marks its first anniversary embroiled in controversy. The latest uproar involves the murderers of Steve Biko, a leading anti-apartheid activist in the 1970s and head of the Black Consciousness Movement. Five former policemen have confessed to killing Biko in 1977 during an interrogation in a Port Elizabeth police station. But as part of a deal with the Truth Commission, the five will likely receive amnesty in return for their confession to the crime. The amnesty provision for Steve Biko's murderers has again sparked criticism of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the almost total lack of justice for the victims of the brutal apartheid regime in South Africa. We'll have more on that story later. But first on Democracy Now!, we'll hear from one of the leading jurists in South Africa, Richard J. Goldstone, a South African Constitutional Court judge and the former lead prosecutor in the United Nations War Crime Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. Richard Goldstone spoke Monday night at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. The subject of his talk was war crime tribunals and the South African Truth Commission.
So the Truth Commission was a political compromise. It was a compromise between amnesia on the one hand and criminal trials on the other. There was a trade-off. For truth, for confession, you get an indemnity. Not automatically, and criteria appear very clearly in the statute setting up the Truth Commission. There has to have been a political motive in order to qualify for the indemnity, and there has to be some proportionality between that motive and the human rights violations which were committed. Over 4,000 applications have been received by the South African Truth Commission for indemnity. Over 4,000 applications with confessions, with full details of the crimes in respect of which the indemnity is asked for. Today in South Africa, five policemen have applied, become public, have applied for indemnity, five policemen who admit that they participated in the death and the murder of Steve Biko, a very important leader who was killed in police custody in the 1980s. Now, it's an interesting example because the family of Mr. Biko came to our Constitutional Court in 1995 and asked the court to declare the Whole Truth Commission unconstitutional. They said, we want compensation because the Truth Commission legislation cuts out not only criminal prosecution, but also civil claims. They came to the Constitutional Court and they said, this is not consistent with our human rights. We want these people to be prosecuted and we want compensation. And our Constitutional Court, with grave misgivings and with great difficulty, but unanimously, came to the conclusion that the Constitution made express provision for the Truth Commission and that the legislation creating it fell within the terms of the Constitution. The Truth Commission was referred to as a bridge between the past of human rights violations and the future of a democratic nation, a democratic country, where there's a respect for human rights and a human rights culture can be built. And I thought to myself today when I heard the news of this latest application made public by the Truth Commission that I hope, because one can only feel sympathy for the victims who want full justice, but I thought to myself, had there been full justice, nobody, the Biko family, would not have known the names or the identity of the people who were responsible for that sort of ghastly deed in police cells. The worst thing one can think about are security forces, policemen, army, people who are given arms, who are paid by the state to protect people, using those very powers and using those very resources to kill people and to torture people. So the Truth Commission, could have gone wrong. It's a high risk, and I believe all important things in life carry a risk. If there's no risk, they're not important. If they can't go wrong, then they're not really worth fighting for because they're not very important. The Truth Commission carried a risk, but it's succeeding, I would think, beyond the expectations of many people. It has advantages over prosecutions. It's inclusive. 4,500 people asking for an indemnity. Imagine staging 4,000 trials, putting 4,000 people on trial. The most efficient justice system in the world couldn't cope. It would take years, take longer than the perpetrators will live to put them all on trial. The Truth Commission only has, in South Africa's case, a 2-year life. 1 year is gone. It will finish its work at the end of the current year. It's inclusive. It will deal with thousands of cases. It will have heard thousands of victims. It will have heard thousands of applications for indemnity. So one will get a complete picture of the human rights abuses during a period of many decades in South Africa. And the report of that commission, I believe, is going to play a very important role in allowing South Africa to reconcile, to bring proper acknowledgement to the victims. And we have to be careful, because the victims are not only the victims of the sorts of offences, the sorts of violations I've been talking. The victims also are the many millions of South Africans who had to suffer the petty but terrible laws which caused them, and I say petty in a very in quotation marks, the people who went to prison by the millions over the apartheid years for not carrying their identification document, their pass, the hundreds of thousands who were kicked out of their homes because it was in a wrong area, in an area reserved for white people. Those too are coming before the Truth Commission. The Truth Commission is dealing with it. It's calling on organizations, political parties, professions. It's calling on the medical profession and the legal profession and probably the judiciary to account in public for the things that, for its involvement, for their involvement in the offenses that were committed. And it's important, and I really, as a South African, feel a great deal of optimism and hope and pride that in my country, these sorts of offenses, that history, is being brought fully into the open, transparently, for all to see, and for the history to be recorded. I agree, it's difficult to conceptualize a proportionality between a political motive on the one hand and the murder or torture of innocent people on the other. But that's the deal. And the benefit, and it's an important benefit that the victims get, is the fact that it's made public. Without the Truth Commission, you'd have no form of justice. They would get away with it completely. So it must bring some feeling of solace, and it is. That's the experience to many victims, that at least they found out who the perpetrator was, not only the identity, but what organization that person came from. And the Truth Commission, too, is having the effect of going up the ladder, because people who are coming forward are not simply accepting the blame. They're saying, we acted under orders, and the orders were given by so-and-so. And so-and-so is brought in, and he blames somebody higher up who gave him the orders, who was giving a nod and a wink. So these are important benefits, and especially if one weighs them up against the alternative, which is not knowing anything at all. Without the Truth Commission, the people who were involved in the Biko murder would not be known. And I would imagine it's difficult, obviously, one can't put oneself in the position of victims. I don't know, but I can only imagine that I would prefer to know who was responsible for killing a loved one than not knowing and having some right which I can't exercise. I don't know, but I would imagine that.
Question about why the United States... I gather you heard the question, why the United States and Great Britain were exhibiting cowardice in arresting indicted persons.
I wish I knew the answers. All I can say is that it's clearly a political issue. It's bound up, too, with what I see as double standards between what's allowed to happen in a nation state and what's allowed to happen in the international community. It's a commentary on all of us. I was introduced to a former British Prime Minister the week I was appointed to become the prosecutor in The Hague. I was introduced to him during a private visit he was paying to Cape Town. And the British ambassador introduced me to him, and he said that I'd been appointed to go to The Hague, and the former Prime Minister said yes, he'd read about it. And in front of at least 10 people, he turned to me and said, why on earth have you taken such a ridiculous job? And I said, because I thought it was important that war criminals should be brought to book, and this was the first time it had been done, and I felt it was a very important duty that I'd accepted. And he said, well, no, he said, I can't disagree more. He said, if people want to kill each other in other countries, it's not our business. Let them get on with it and let them do it. Well, that's not an uncommon attitude on the part of many people, and may well be the majority of people in European countries and in this country. I don't know. If there was a referendum on whether United States troops should be put in danger arresting war criminals, I'd be pleasantly surprised if a majority of people in any of the countries involved would vote affirmatively. Yet, in their own country, it's taken for granted. If a warrant of arrest is out for a serious murderer, somebody who's committed rape, nobody thinks twice about putting policemen in danger. The most dangerous criminals are picked up. Imagine the fate of any police chief or cabinet member who'd say, we're not going to spill the blood of a policeman to bring in a dangerous murderer. Not worth the blood of a policeman. There'd be an absolute uproar. No such politician, no such police chief would remain in office for 24 hours. Yet that's exactly what's said in the international community, not for a murderer, but for somebody accused of genocide. Somebody accused of being responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of people, for putting millions of people into refugees and displaced person status, for the rape of tens of thousands of women, and yet a British officer can get up and not be reprimanded and say it's not worth spilling the blood of a single IFOR troop to go and arrest any war criminal. So there's a double standard. And what's to be done about it, I only can believe that it can be public pressure. If decent people don't put up with it, stop putting up with it, only then will governments change the attitude and do what their own troops would like them to do, because they prepare to do it. People don't join the army. People don't become a policeman. People don't accept uniforms and arms with the expectation or with the intent that they're never going to be used. One thing I've learned, and particularly in South Africa, is the importance to victims of public official acknowledgement. In most criminal cases in a country, certainly in a great number of criminal cases, the victims know what happened to them. They were the victims. And in most cases, they know who the perpetrators were. So they don't need justice to tell them what happened. But they still want justice. They still go and make a complaint, and they still want the victim brought to court, not only because they want retribution, but they want a public acknowledgement, an official acknowledgement of what happened to them. It's part of the healing process, and one's seen it in the last months in South Africa. Hundreds, not thousands, of victims of apartheid coming to the Truth Commission, crying, tears flowing down not only their eyes, but down the faces of the commissioners themselves. And the story again and again, when they leave, is that they leave as better people, as people who can begin their healing process. And that's been our experience in The Hague. Witnesses who've come from small villages, terrified, never traveled before, find themselves in an alien country. They don't speak Dutch. They're not used to being under witness protection in a comfortable hotel room. The food isn't what they used to. They come terrified, broken people, and the effect of giving evidence in public, and they all choose to do it in public, with few exceptions. They're given the option of doing it with their identity concealed. They don't want that. They've told us they want their voices to be heard, they want their faces to be seen, because they're speaking not only for themselves, but for other victims in the areas in the country from which they come. And when they left The Hague, they were different people. Their healing process was able to begin because they felt they were able to play some role in restoring the pride, the wholeness of them, not only themselves, but of other people who went through what they did. The truth that justice brings also helps identify and helps the dismantling of the sorts of institutions that have been responsible for what has happened. It's been particularly important in South Africa, in other countries where there have been truth commissions, and it applies no less to criminal justice in the cases of the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda.
Richard Goldstone, a South African Constitutional Court judge and the lead prosecutor for the United Nations War Crimes Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. Up next, we get reaction to the official revelation of who murdered Steve Biko in South Africa. You're listening to Democracy Now! We will be back in 60 seconds.
Oh, Africa, nobody ever apologized. For when your blood ran red and your country was stolen by the whites, they took your land and your home and shut you down when you tried to refuse. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa, nobody ever said it was wrong. Though you cried long and loud in your pain when your life was gone. But no one cared, they took you slaves and changed your life and your culture too. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission has marked its first anniversary. This is the halfway point this month. Not unexpectedly, the commission has sparked a lot of controversy in South Africa, particularly over the practice of granting amnesty to confessed killers and torturers during the apartheid regime. Just this week, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, known as the TRC, found itself at the center of another storm, this time around Steve Biko, the leading anti-apartheid activist in the 1970s and head of the Black Consciousness Movement. Five former policemen have confessed to killing Biko in 1977 during an interrogation in a Port Elizabeth police station. But as part of a deal with the TRC, the five will likely receive amnesty in return for their confession. We go now to South Africa. We're joined by David Goodman, who's an independent journalist. He's also my brother, and he's writing a book on post-apartheid South Africa. He is the author of the cover story in this week's In These Times, and it's on the South Africa Truth Commission. He's in Cape Town. We're also joined by Fundime Mafangosi. He's the deputy national organizer of ASAPO, the Azanian People's Organization, which is a part of the Black Consciousness Movement founded by Steve Biko. He speaks to us from Grahamstown, South Africa, where Steve Biko was, where he worked, and where he was before he was murdered. And I want to begin with you, Fundime, to ask you about your response to the revelations of who the killers were and how the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, will deal with them, particularly around the issue of amnesty.
In fact, the Azanian People's Organization is not excited nor impressed by the revelations that the five notorious security policemen who participated in the brutal murder of Comrade Steve Biko are now seeking amnesty to the TRC in order to clear their conscience. We believe in the Azanian People's Organization that these five security policemen have committed crime against humanity, and therefore they do not deserve any amnesty. They need to be taken to the court of law where they will be punished severely. That is the position of the Azanian People's Organization.
Why do you think the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has decided to grant amnesty?
I think what they want to do, they want to hoodwink the people in Azania and the international world into believing that justice has been done in the case of Stephen Bantu Biko. Because if you still remember the inquest which was conducted after the death of Biko, the verdict was that none of them, of the security policemen, was found guilty, irrespective of the names that were identified. But I think now what the TRC is trying to do is just to create that false impression that justice is being done. We believe that the case of Stephen Bantu Biko was never given a fair trial and fair hearing. We believe now that now that these five thugs have come out, they need really to be taken to court where justice can be taken.
Fundime, can you explain the significance of Steve Biko?
Steve Bantu Biko, he is the founding father of the Black Consciousness Movement. He's one of the leaders in this country who emerged in the 1960s. And he imbued the spirit in black people, the spirit of black people understanding who they are, what do they want, and how best can they struggle for genuine liberation. Steve Bantu Biko is one of the leaders in this country who has managed to influence black people to understand that this country is not called South Africa, this country is not called New South Africa, this country is called Azania, and this country belongs to them and to them alone. And he went further to teach black people to understand that no one can bring about liberation of black people unless black people come together and fight for their freedom. Steve Bantu Biko, he went further to say that the liberation of black people can only come through their collective effort. And he went further to say that the removal of apartheid will not necessarily mean that black people have regained their freedom. He went further to say the liberation of black people will only come when black people are in charge of the economic affairs of this country. So we are talking about that man, and there is no way that we can simply wish away his ideas. His ideas, they are still relevant even in 1997.
What do you think he would say about South Africa today?
If you have read his book, I Write What I Like, he anticipated this situation that there will come a time when white faces will be replaced by black faces, but the economy of the country will continue to be in the hands of white people. And he used to call that stage as a stage of neo-colonialism, and this is what we are experiencing in South Africa today. Black people are not yet liberated. The people who enjoy the necessities of life are white people, and therefore the struggle needs to continue.
And what happened to Steve Biko in 1977?
In 1977, Steve Bantu Biko, he was arrested in this place where I'm phoning now, an area called Grahamstown. There was a roadblock which was set up for him. That was in August 1977. He was taken to Sanlam Building, that is in Port Elizabeth, which is about 130 kilometers from Grahamstown. And he was stripped naked. He was chained. He was tortured. He was beaten. And it is reported that on the 11th of September, he was transferred in a Land Rover where he was naked. There was no food. There was nothing for him to drink. And he was transferred to Pretoria at the back of a Land Rover, which is an area from P to Pretoria is about 950 kilometers. And on his arrival, he was certified dead. And the minister at that time, P.J. Foster, Jimmy Kruger, he said that Steve Bantu Biko used his democratic rights to starve himself to death because they portrayed as if he was on hunger strike, whereas he was not. He was murdered.
Fundime Mafungosi is the deputy national organizer of AZAPO, the Azanian People's Organization, a part of the Black Consciousness Movement founded by Steve Biko, murdered in 1977, speaking to us from Grahamstown, South Africa. David Goodman joins us from Cape Town. David, you've been following the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the last 8 months of its operation. You wrote the cover story of In These Times this week on the issue. How is it that the murderers of Steve Biko, as well as many others, will be granted amnesty?
Yeah, well, let me just correct you on one thing. The Biko's killers, these five policemen whose identities were revealed yesterday, have not been given amnesty. They're They have applied for amnesty. They will now have to appear in a public hearing where they will be questioned, and then a decision will be taken on whether or not to grant them amnesty. That's an important distinction because the South Africa is one of the few countries, post-authoritarian countries, where amnesty is not being given automatically. Blanket amnesty has been given in a number of Latin American countries, but the ANC had resisted that in the deal that was struck in South Africa. Now, having said that, I can say pretty confidently that these five policemen will be given amnesty. I, in fact, last night asked a member of the Truth Commission if that would be the case, and he said, of course, they must. And the reason that he says that is that what the Truth Commission has demonstrated in the last month is that they are taking a very broad read of their mandate to give amnesty. There was some hope that the commission can deny amnesty to people if they decide that a crime was out of proportion to its stated political aims. Now, critics of the commission invested great hope that they would use that clause to deny amnesty to the killers of, say, the Steve Bikos or the Chris Hanis. These were major leaders of the liberation struggle here. But last month, in the case of a security policeman who was implicated in a massacre of 11 people, Brian Mitchell, he applied for and received amnesty. And basically, the commission was sending out notice that they would be giving a very generous read of their amnesty charge. And if somebody like Mitchell could be given amnesty for having killed 11 people, then clearly most of the people who applied for amnesty would be getting it.
And what is the reaction of the commissioners on the Truth and Justice, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission? How do they stomach this?
The Truth commissioners who I spoke to in the aftermath of the Brian Mitchell decision, which was the first major amnesty decision, this just happened a month ago, so this is very much in its infancy, this whole amnesty process, they were quite shaken because even they had thought that the notorious killers would not be getting amnesty. But it was made clear by the Amnesty Committee, which is sort of a semi-secretive, special, quasi-judicial body within the commission itself, that they were basically going to give amnesty to those who applied, with very few exceptions. And they also, the Mitchell decision was also intended as a signal, in that the Truth Commission, by and large, has failed to reel in the big fish, the generals, and that includes this Biko case. All of these five policemen whose identities were revealed yesterday, who were applying for amnesty for the Biko case, none of these guys are the top brass. These guys were the foot soldiers of apartheid. They are, albeit a very notorious lot, as Fundime has pointed out, the security police of that area, Port Elizabeth, were considered the most sadistic of all the security police units in South Africa. But the guys who gave the orders, the generals, the former presidents, the ministers, none of them have come forward. And everything that the Truth Commission has done to try and get these guys to come forward has so far failed. So by letting it be known that they would be giving more amnesties than not, they had hoped to start reeling in the big fish. But so far, still, those guys have remained outside their grasp.
David, lawyers for the Biko family have argued that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is unconstitutional because its powers to grant amnesties denied the victims the right to have disputes settled in court. In fact, I hear that the justice system, that judges are angry in South Africa, that they're feeling that their cases are being preempted by granting killers amnesty. What about this?
the Truth Commission process does preempt justice, and it does preclude these guys from getting prosecuted. And that is exactly the deal that was struck in 1993. And it has to be understood that the commission is the result of a political compromise. It was one of the most contentious issues in the negotiations that led up to democratic elections in South Africa in April 1994. The National Party under F.W. de Klerk was demanding a blanket amnesty for all its security force people. The ANC was insisting, was holding out, and of course the ANC initially held out for trials, normal criminal trials that happen in normal societies. But this is not a normal society here with the history that it's had. The best that the ANC could manage was an agreement that there would be a truth commission, and they did manage to prevent the blanket amnesty and instead had this conditional amnesty where people have to tell all, name their accomplices, hopefully apologize for what they did, and then a commission will decide on whether or not they get it. So that was the deal that was struck. Those who support or defend the commission would simply say that they had no alternative. As one witness before the TRC told me, Father Michael Lapsley, who had both of his hands blown off in a parcel bomb sent by the security police, he said the alternative to the Truth Commission was a war that would consume us all. And that is a view shared by many people, that while they're letting killers go free, they have in fact saved a lot of bloodshed by enabling elections to go forward in 1994. The National Party was determined to stop, to hold the elections hostage unless they got a deal on the truth process. The TRC is basically attacked from all sides. It is hated by most parties. For a long time last year, it was called the Kleenex Commission because all it had was victims giving what are very heart-wrenching stories of their abuse. The Afrikaans-speaking press slams it as the ANC Commission, or simply refers to it as a confessional place. So it is, and the ANC itself announced several months ago at one point that their former liberation fighters, members of their army, Umkhonto Sizwe, would not testify before the commission because they had nothing to apologize for, which prompted Archbishop Tutu to say he would quit if they did that because it would basically negate the whole process. So the ANC has since recanted on that after Mandela met with Tutu. So the job that it has been charged with is not one that anybody's particularly comfortable with, and I would say that the amnesty process has really rubbed salt in these wounds. When the Biko's killers come forward and basically will get amnesty, it is really brought to the forefront for the first time since this deal was made in 1993 what the consequences of the political jockeying were that brought about elections in South Africa.
Well, David, that about does it. We're just out of time. David Goodman, independent journalist. You can check out his article on the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, cover story of In These Times this week. David is writing a book on post-apartheid South Africa. We've also been joined by Fundime Mafongosi, the deputy national organizer of ASAPO, the Azanian People's Organization, part of the Black Consciousness Movement founded by Steve Biko. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Errol Maitland has also been our engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned tomorrow on Democracy Now! When we deal with the issue of breast cancer. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We go out with Sorry Africa. Tony Bird singing.
Oh, Africa! Nobody ever apologized for when your blood ran red and your country was stolen by the whites. They took your land and your home and shut you down when you tried to refuse. But I'm sorry, Africa. I'm sorry for my people. I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa.